The one national program that we are announcing today will ensure that there is one and only one set of national fuel economy standards as Congress mandated and intended. No state has the authority to opt out of the nation's rules, and no state has the right to impose its policies on everybody else in our whole country.
Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao this morning. California is in a battle with the Trump administration over fuel efficiency standards, with California setting much higher standards for how much a car can pollute. 13 other states and D.C. have followed California's lead. Over the years, the automobile industry has reshaped to comply with California and the other states. And part of the plan for GM is building more electric cars. CEO Mary Barra has launched an ambitious and financially risky plan to shut down some smaller car lines in order to build electric cars. And that's one reason for the current labor strike. It takes fewer workers to make EVs. Ultimately, GM wants to stop building gas and diesel-powered cars altogether. Joining me now is David Welch, Detroit Bureau Chief for Bloomberg Businessweek. Hi.
Hello.
Well, first of all, can you explain why it takes fewer workers and different workers to create an EV than a gas-powered vehicle?
That's sort of the conventional wisdom. I've never seen anybody prove it out, but I will take a stab at that. There are a lot fewer mechanical parts, so a lot of what operates an electric car is actually electronic circuitry and sending signals from the steering wheel and the other controls to the parts that actually do the acceleration or the braking. And you don't have a whole exhaust system. You don't have a whole fuel system. You do have batteries and other things that replace that. But generally, it's fewer parts on board. And the idea is it requires a lot less assembly. That has not been true in Tesla plants, by the way, because they are labor-intensive and they're not great at manufacturing. But it is kind of the theory among automakers that you should be able to do it with less labor. And it's probably correct just because there are fewer parts.
Well, GM has laid off a bunch of workers and shut down some plants. Is that because it's restructuring to address the EV and driverless car future?
Yeah, the two are related, but not directly related. I'll explain. A few years ago, General Motors started cutting back on the core auto business, selling cars to people who put gasoline in them and drive them with their own two hands. They did it in Europe. They sold that business. They pulled out of Russia. They pulled out of the Indian market, a few Southeast Asian markets, because they just weren't making much money or they were losing a lot of money there. And the idea was not only to stop losing money in the core business where they had always had trouble, but they knew that they would be investing heavily in self-driving car technology and in electric vehicles. And they also knew that it's tough to make money on either one of those, if not impossible, in the early going, and it may be years before that happens. So you've got to fund that development with the current business, and you can't be losing money on that business if that's the plan. So
yeah.
As they did all of that, they bought Cruise Automation, which is now called GM Cruise. It's the San Francisco self-driving car company. They paid $1.5 billion for it, and they plow $1 billion a year into it. And they're spending a lot of money to develop electric vehicles. And hey, give credit to Tesla. Right now, they're the only company that can sell electric cars in big numbers. Everybody else has had a tough time. So it's a very uncertain bet to spend a lot of money on electric cars. It's going to have to happen. I think that's where the world is going. They think that's where the world is going, and I think they're right. But it may be a timing issue, and that's why there's risk for GM to go as aggressively as they have.
Well, here, even in California, EV sales are really low, and very few people buy electric cars. I think they total about 5% of the state's car sales.
And that's a big number, by the way. Nationally, it's 1% or less.
Oh, wow. So this is a risky bet on GM's part, at least in the near future, right?
It is. And now, look, the bigger risk may be not doing it or doing it too late. What GM's gamble here, of these two technologies kind of has a different bet. With electric cars, what GM thinks they can do is they can get to large numbers of sales before others, drive the cost of batteries down, and sell them profitably faster than someone like Tesla could, or even some of the luxury brands, because they're a mass market car company. They have a big presence in China, where the government is giving incentives to sell electric vehicles and for people to buy them. And they can get a scale advantage, basically, and make more money on them. That's the electric play. On the autonomous side, their philosophy is that you're not going to need 12 or 14 different companies that can make the software and the computer brains that make an autonomous vehicle make the right decisions and drive itself. It'll be more like you have iOS on your iPhone and you have Android on your Samsung smartphones. You have an Apple operating system for computers, so you're only going to need a handful of operating systems for these cars. So if GM can get out there first, they can sell it to others. They can get Robotaxi and automated delivery services up in cities, get a brand name for it, and establish a beachhead in the big cities where it's going to make a difference. And then they can get a lead there and make a lot of money.
So California made this deal with four automakers to keep the existing emission standards in place. And now the DOJ is investigating whether there's some form of collusion there. But GM was not one of those four. Why not?
That's right. GM's point in this for quite some time now is that there should be one standard. They are trying to, they're kind of like the tortured middle child. They don't want to make California angry. They don't want to make Trump angry. It also is much easier for a car company to meet one standard. You can basically, you know, make all of your vehicles, design, engineer them so that they meet one set of rules. It is easier to do that. What everybody has typically done is they meet the California standard, which are a little tougher than the national standards. So by going by California's rules, you meet everything anyways. And everybody in the business kind of figures rules are going to get tougher across the globe anyhow. So they may as well develop the technology. They may as well make their vehicles lighter and get better fuel economy and cleaner emissions. Just do it because you have to get there anyways. And, the fight has always been over how quickly you do it. That was the fight they had with the Obama administration and with California. And GM sees a much more friendly administration for that in the Trump administration. And if he ends up writing the rules, then it's a lot easier for them. And they make all their money on pickup trucks and SUVs. So, hey, that's good for their business.
Right. So they're still going to plow ahead with this EV plan, despite all this
back and forth. Yeah. And there's a big reason for that is actually China. In China, the government is mandating what they call new energy vehicles, basically amounts to strong plug-in hybrids and mostly electric vehicles. The Chinese government really wants it. They have a lot of issues in the cities with really bad pollution over there. And also, China loves technology, and they love when somebody else designs it and brings it to them. And so they mandate that German and American car companies and Japanese car companies have to bring their best EVs over there. Then they get the technology, whether their own companies can develop it or not. And U.S. car companies, German car companies make pretty good money in China. So that's a big driver of this. The question I have for GM is if Trump does this and if he wins in court against California and the EV mandate in California goes away, will GM throttle back, and not just GM but all car makers, will they throttle back, so to speak, on their plans to sell electric vehicles in the U.S.? Instead of making 6, 7, or 8 of them, will it be 2 or 3? And will it be, you know, much more modest volumes instead of trying to sell them in big numbers? What Trump's doing really could set EVs back quite a bit if he gives mass market car companies a reprieve on really having to push into this.
David Welch, Detroit Bureau Chief for Bloomberg Businessweek. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the LA County Board of Supervisors votes to urge the Supreme Court to overturn a ban on clearing homeless encampments. Reaction from a former supervisor, Zev Yaroslavsky, next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW Donation Car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. President Trump is back in Washington after his two-day swing through California. While he was here, he attacked Los Angeles and San Francisco over their homelessness problem. He called it a terrible situation. On Tuesday, the LA County Board of Supervisors voted to file a legal brief with the Supreme Court, urging it to overturn a ruling that allows the homeless to sleep on the streets when there isn't shelter space. The vote was 3-2 to file this amicus brief. There's a growing feeling of frustration when it comes to California's homeless crisis. Are we at a tipping point? And has President Trump tapped into something when he says homelessness is destroying L.A. and San Francisco? Xavier Oslovsky joins me now. He's a former L.A. County supervisor, former city councilman, now director of the L.A. Initiative at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. Hi there.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thanks. All right. So give me a reaction to that vote by the LA County supervisors. It didn't seem characteristic of them, but it did seem to express a sense of frustration with the growing tent encampments on our city streets.
Well, I think the close vote also reflects the difficulty of the issue. On the one hand, you can't have people sleeping on the streets, blocking entrances to people's businesses and creating a health problem. On the other hand, you have to have a place to shelter them or to house them more appropriately. And it's a difficult issue. So the Boise case, which they filed the amicus brief in, is a case that's taking national, it has national implications. Cities and counties all over the country are weighing in on it. And I think this board, if I know them well enough, wants to have the discretion to do some things in a humane and intelligent way. If a homeless person is blocking a business, to be able to take that homeless person and give them temporary shelter or housing or get them into a program, not just disperse them from the area and not just kick them out.
Mm-hmm. I think the people who were opposed to this, and there was a big group of people at the meeting the other day voicing their opposition, basically are afraid that this will give authorities the legal right to just clear the homeless, remove them, without putting them in any shelter, because there isn't enough shelter.
Well, I don't think that's going to be the case in Los Angeles. I don't know what it's like in Boise or in some of the other communities. That's not going to be the case any longer in Los Angeles. But, you know, it wasn't that long ago, a few years ago, that the city of Los Angeles did disperse the homeless from Skid Row after years of a policy of containing them in Skid Row. And dispersal is not a good strategy. And I don't think anybody who's followed the homeless issue, as I have, believes that dispersal is a good strategy. It's counterproductive. The only way you solve the homeless problem is to give homeless people a home, a housing unit, and the services needed to address the issues that rendered them homeless in the first place. Anything short of that is destined to failure. So that's what the city and the county are now trying to do. It's a time-consuming undertaking. It requires a lot of patience, but I think they're on the right track.
What about what President Trump has proposed, albeit very vaguely, easing rules on development? That's something that people on the left have also called for, that there are too many restrictions on building new housing that adds years onto construction and just causes a very slow process and an expensive process, to be fair. Do you think that there should be some deregulation?
No, I don't think there should be some deregulation. In Los Angeles, we have the ability to build in the city of L.A., 600,000, 700,000, or 800,000, depending on whose figures you believe, new units without a single deregulation, without a single zone change, without a single upzoning. The proposals that have come out of Sacramento to eliminate the single-family homes and the duplex zones and the quadruplex zones of the city and allow seven-story massive apartment buildings with no parking is not the answer.
Are you talking about SB 50?
SB 50 and related bills that have come up. The bottom line is this. We have an affordable housing crisis. We don't have a market-rate housing crisis. In the west side of Los Angeles and downtown and central part of the city, there are more construction projects going on for apartments than have taken place in 30 years. Los Angeles actually approved more apartments in 2018 than they had in any year since 1981. So there is an increase in supply, but they're of market rate housing. And the people who are squeezed in this housing environment are people who are of low and moderate income. And that's 40-45% of the people who live in the city. Mm-hmm. Those are the renters that can't afford to pay market rate rents. And so you have two different economies. You have the market rate housing economy and the affordable economy. And the affordable side has to be addressed with some assistance to the market. And that's where Trump coming in here and saying, lecturing to us what's wrong with our housing policy. You ought to look in the mirror, because his tax bill made it more difficult, less economical to build apartment buildings. He's cut back on homeless housing. He's cut back on HUD housing subsidies for low and moderate income people. Those are the things that are producing more homeless today than at any other time in our history.
So you don't think it's a question of supply and demand? Some economists have said, look, if we had a big supply, housing prices would fall. And that would help the situation. And
yeah, I was an economics major in college, and I remember my first microeconomics class when they showed the supply and demand curve. The professor warned us, this is perfect competition. This graph represents perfect competition, and there is no such thing as perfect competition. So the fact is that if it was a perfect world, you increase the supply, the price will come down. But look at the costs. The cost of land are off the charts. The cost of construction have gone up. The cost of materials have gone up. There's a shortage of construction workers now, so you pay a premium for contractors. All of that contributes to what the ultimate rental price is on the unit you build. And so no matter how you cut it, you increase the supply, you're increasing the supply at a cost of construction that is far greater than and requires a much higher monthly rent than an affordable unit that's been here for 40 years. And there's no way around that economic reality either. If density was the only thing that mattered, New York wouldn't have a high cost of housing, would it? Mm. Manhattan wouldn't be the top of the line rental market. And Los Angeles and San Francisco and other very attractive job magnets, especially in the high-tech world. Those communities are now seeing an even greater squeeze. So part of it is you have to increase the people's incomes. The income inequality is what's driving so much of this. So yeah. Incomes have to rise. It's not simple. It didn't happen overnight. It's not going to be ended overnight.
Understood. Still, a lot of people are looking at the growing tent encampments and feeling like, why isn't this Mayor Garcetti's Hurricane Katrina moment, a moment where the city and other leaders can't galvanize the rest of the city to take an all hands on deck approach, to make this like a national emergency level approach?
Well, I think Eric Garcetti is finally doing everything he can and his administration can do to build more affordable housing, to build more housing for homeless, permanent supportive housing for homeless. I know the county of Los Angeles is doing the same thing. There's more money available now, thanks to the voters who have assessed themselves a tax to do something about this issue. But as I said, this problem didn't occur overnight. Homelessness has developed over a period of decades, and in fact, maybe even a century in Los Angeles, and it's not going to be solved overnight. And the public, I think one of the mistakes that the political leaders have made, and I made it myself when I was in politics, is promising more than we could deliver. And I think what political leaders need to tell us all today is, we're going to solve this problem, but it's going to take time. Be patient with us. We're going to make a dent. You're going to see an improvement, but you have to hang with us. And if in the next 5 years we don't see a significant reduction in homelessness on the streets, a significant reduction of encampments, then we have some people to hold accountable. But it's not realistic to expect that over a 2 or 3 year period you're going to reverse a trend that has been going on for decades.
Zev Yaroslavsky, always great to speak with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Mark Medlin. My pleasure.
All right. Zev Yaroslavsky, he's former L.A. County Supervisor and Director of the L.A. Initiative at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. Well, speaking of President Trump, we wanted to fact check another one of his claims about homelessness in California. He said, quote, tremendous pollution was flowing into the Pacific Ocean via storm drains and sewers. He specifically mentioned used needles and threatened to fine San Francisco. The mayor, London Breed, said that is ridiculous. David Lewis is executive director of Save the Bay in San Francisco. He's here to help us separate fact from fiction. Hello.
Hello.
So the president was talking about homeless people, drug addicts using needles and saying the needles end up in the bay there in San Francisco. Is that at all accurate?
It's extremely unlikely. In fact, San Francisco is one of the places where that's least likely to happen because the stormwater that goes down the drains in the streets and the sewage water that goes down the drains in your house actually goes to the same place. Goes to a sewage treatment plant where all the solids are separated and the water is cleaned before it goes into the bay and the ocean. Now, trash and stormwater is a big problem in California because in many places the stormwater goes directly into the nearest creek or culvert, the LA River, for example, and then out into the bay or the ocean. And so trash and stormwater is a problem, and homeless encampments can't contribute to that trash. There's a lot of work being done in Los Angeles and other places in California to reduce that. But San Francisco, that's probably the place where it's least likely to happen.
So maybe he should have been talking about L.A. when he made that comment.
I wouldn't want to speculate about why he picks on San Francisco, and the comments don't seem to me to be particularly helpful on homelessness. But he's also about the least qualified person to be complaining about pollution since his administration is trying to dismantle the Clean Water Act and other pollution laws that have kept us safe and cleaner for many years.
All right. Well, talk about the situation here in L.A. when it comes to storm drains. You just mentioned the L.A. River. So it doesn't have this separate system that you were talking about where it takes out the solid waste that you have up in San Francisco.
Well, that's right. And so there's been a big effort over the last 10 years to try to reduce the amount of trash that's getting out into Santa Monica Bay and the ocean through the storm drain system, because everything that's on our streets ends up in the ocean unless it's prevented from getting there. So that means more aggressive street sweeping, but it also means installing screens and grates to limit the amount of trash that gets down the drain and out into the ocean.
All right. Well, thank you so much for clearing that up for us.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
David Lewis, Executive Director of Save the Bay in San Francisco. Coming up, how a boy with dyslexia and ADHD learned to embrace his differences.
One day I asked her, hey, Mom, am I normal? And my mom turned to me and said, Jonathan, normal sucks. So my reframe started right there with her.
The author of a new book, Normal Sucks, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. When you're a kid, probably the worst thing is not fitting in, being a weirdo, not being normal. Well, for Jonathan Mooney, it was torture. He couldn't read until the age of 12. He was put in a slow class. Some of the kids called him retard. It took him years to realize that he was not inferior and that his goal to be normal wasn't really what he should have been striving for. Jonathan Mooney is now an author and public speaker. His latest book is called Normal Sucks. And Jonathan Mooney joins me now. Hi.
Hey, Madeline.
Okay, so were you diagnosed as a child?
I was. I mean, I had first and foremost the very sophisticated diagnosis of being the stupid, crazy, lazy kid. You know, that was the first set of labels that came out of the...
Was that a label from adults and kids?
That, That was a label from adults, kids, and ultimately, you know, myself. And it's not an uncommon set of labels. I hear it from young people all around the country with learning and attentional differences that's how they feel. Eventually, those labels were replaced with more clinical diagnoses. I was diagnosed with dyslexia and a whole bunch of other language-based learning disabilities in fourth grade, and diagnosed with attentional deficit hyperactivity disorder in fifth grade, and then struggled with a bunch of mental health challenges throughout my adolescence, anxiety and depression.
Mm. And was the anxiety and depression related to the dyslexia and the ADHD and being labeled, as you say, stupid, crazy, and lazy?
A complicated mix. You know, we know that the sort of neurology of learning and attentional differences runs really close to anxiety and depression and the same neurological pathways. We also know that growing up chilling out with the janitor in the hallway like I did, or growing up on a first name basis with Shirley the receptionist in the principal's office, or hiding in the bathroom to escape reading out loud, that doesn't help with the anxiety or the depression. So it's a complicated mix of predisposition that becomes exacerbated by the way differences are treated.
So this was what, in the 80s and...
Yeah, this was in the 80s. You know, I had the rat tail haircut to prove it.
but back then, like, people didn't really understand ADHD or dyslexia the way they do now.
Yes and no. I mean, I was the first sort of wave of replacing the stupid, crazy, lazy label with more clinical diagnoses. And there were a lot of progress made during that period around services for folks who learn differently and educational advancement. And we've come a long way still. But what's interesting to me is I still hear from kids, you know, every day, every talk I give via email, Facebook, Instagram, I hear folks with differences feeling not different, but deficient. Hmm. And we still got a long way to go.
Hmm. And when did you first come up with that? How did you begin to reframe it?
Well, it was a long road. You know, I struggled in school even after being diagnosed. You know, I grew up in the stupid reading group, right? We all know they're there, you know. And I spend most of the day chilling out with C-Spot Run, you know. So I struggled in school. I left for a time in sixth grade. I had a plan for suicide that year that I left. And I struggled with a sense of being deficient and not different. So coming to that reframe was a long journey. It was facilitated by a lot of folks in my life. And one of them was my mom. You know, I would not have survived that experience if it wasn't for my mom. My mom's quite a character. You know, she's like 4'9" on a good day in high heels. She has a very high-pitched, squeaky voice like Minnie Mouse, and she curses like a truck driver. And one day I asked her, "Hey, Mom, am I normal?" And my mom turned to me and said, "Jonathan, normal sucks." So my reframe started right there with her.
But as a parent, I wonder if she struggled with that, because it's really difficult to watch your kid not be quote-unquote normal.
She struggled with that. She struggled with that parental instinct to protect your children. You know, one of the things is when you get diagnosed, there's a relentless sort of remediation industrial economy that wants to make the square peg fit the round hole. But my mom rejected that, you know. She thought her job was not to fix me, but to fight for me. And she was an advocate to not change me, but to change the environment around me. She said, you know what? The investment and cost to change your brain does not warrant the outcome. You're not making progress. So she advocated for, you know, the accommodation of books on tape. That accommodation of listening helped me stay engaged as a thinker, as a student, as a human. And eventually she also accommodated my struggles with writing. I spelled a third grade level to this day. And my mom let me dictate. So this is a false dichotomy between listening and reading. We say one is better than the other. They're both good. It's a false dichotomy to say writing is better than speaking. They're both good. And my mom got to that line where the making of the square peg fit the round hole broke the peg.
But I imagine, though, it would be a whole lot easier if we had a really robust social safety net to help parents like your mom navigate all of this and get the services for their kids. And it just makes it a lot harder to buck normalcy when you don't have a lot of help.
You know, my mom lived that herself. My mom had my brother when she was 16. She had my sister when she was 17 and a half. She had my other sister when she was 19. And she found herself a single mom on public assistance, navigating demoralizing, soul-crushing bureaucracies that are inequitable in their nature and push out folks without power. And that's a real lived experience of inequity when it comes to neurodiversity that we have to wrestle with. We know more than ever that a good proportion of folks in prison are folks who struggled in school in the ways that I did. We know more than ever that the unemployment rate for folks with atypical brains and bodies is the highest out of any minority community in the world. And that requires us to reframe how we think about it, not as a tragedy. That's the sort of disability model, right? It's a tragedy when somebody with a disability fails. But it's not a tragedy. It's really a crime. It's a form of sort of systemic injustice that we have to wrestle with, that we have to include in our broader human project of building a more inclusive world that we all are embarking on right now. And we can't leave out of that conversation, that discourse, the folks who live and learn differently.
But isn't it the case that in our culture, we want to be normal when we're kids, and it's really important to fit in and have approval from our peers? It's a big deal. But on the other hand, we're celebrating people who strike out and create things like Steve Jobs, for example, who don't appear to be normal in any way, but end up being completely worshipped for their brilliance.
Yeah, well, you're right. I think we have a dissonance in our culture where at times in certain forums, the eccentric, the outlier, the innovator is celebrated for their differences, and we need more of that. The challenge that I have with that, though, is that often we celebrate the Steve Jobs of the world, the different of the world, rightfully so for their achievements and their accomplishments, but that implies that being somebody who is atypical is only okay if you go off to create the iPhone, or if you go off to contribute something exceptional or extraordinary to the world. We need to migrate that same ethic of valuing difference down to everyday folks, you know, everyday people. You know, my difference isn't valuable because I went to Brown University or wrote books. It has to be seen as valuable in and of itself, not for some pragmatic outcome that comes from it. And I've struggled with how to make sense of that. And I've come to a place of an ethics of difference where wrestling with the reality that the only normal people are people you don't know very well requires us to build a new set of ethical principles that govern our school and our community. And while we've celebrated the outliers for what they've succeeded and how they've succeeded, we have a long work to go to build a ethic of difference in our schools, communities, and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Well, Jonathan, I want to thank you so much for sharing your story and your thoughts with us today. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me, Madeline. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. That's Jonathan Mooney. He's the author of the new book, Normal Sucks, How to Live, Learn, and Thrive Outside the Lines. Coming up, a conversation with LA artist Betty Saar, who has a new exhibition up at LACMA. That's coming up next, right here on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Bram. A new exhibition from Los Angeles artist Betty Saar opens this weekend at LACMA. It's called Betty Saar Call and Response, and it looks at the 93-year-old artist's entire career, including the small sketches that would become her finished works. Saar's art is often made out of objects she finds at flea markets and junk stores. Most of her pieces are constructed to tell a story, the story of race in America. In 1972, Betty Saar made her name with a piece called The Liberation of Aunt Jemima. She reconfigured a traditional ceramic mammy figurine, you know, those curvy black women wearing aprons and scarves on their heads. But Saar's mammy holds a pistol in one hand and a shotgun in the other.
And that's why Aunt Jemima became a warrior. And it became my icon, my personal icon of Betty Saar's black Aunt Jemima.
I interviewed Betty Saar 2 years ago at her exhibition at the Craft and Folk Art Museum across the street from LACMA. She was 90 then, and as we toured the gallery, the first thing that caught my eye was a small white dress on a hanger that said, "A Loss of Innocence," with words, racial slurs, stitched onto the bottom of the dress.
Well, this is a small tableau that I created. The christening dress symbolizes the loss of innocence. No matter how much beauty you have or how much beauty surrounds you, there's still the ugliness of racism. And for young children, it's about all the names that are called pickaninny, tar baby, nigger baby, all of those things that are just so negative about the innocence of being a child.
How old were you when you heard one of those words?
Elementary school, maybe second or third grade or something like that.
And do you remember the word itself?
Nigger. Yeah, that would be the word. But I remember talking to my mother and asked her, why did they say black nigger? Why did they say that? She said, well, you know, this is my mother's way of describing racism. It's like children are like flowers in a garden. They're all different colors. You know, and you're just one color, and sometimes people don't like that color. But that's not who you are. That's not who you are, so.
That's a really artistic way of putting it. Very poetic,
yeah.
And artistic.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So was your mother an artist as well?
An artist of sorts, yes. Her mother painted china, because that's what women did, and my paternal grandmother made quilts. Those are womanly arts, you know, painting china, embroidering handkerchiefs. We grew up project-oriented. We did things with our hands, and that was the way we do, and that's the way my girls grew up, and my grandkids, too. They make things. So I've sort of founded a dynasty of art and craft.
That's great. After walking through the gallery, we go into a quiet room in the back of the museum to talk more about Betty Saar's life as an artist. And I began by asking her, a native Angeleno, how the city has influenced her.
So I can tell you exactly what influenced me from Los Angeles, which influenced my work and the kind of person I am, is the Watts Towers. My grandmother, she lived in Watts, California, on 113th Street. But once a week, my sister and I would walk with her, like when we were visiting her in the summertime when we were out of school, we would walk up to the main street of Watts and to do the shopping, you know, her marketing and so forth. And we would pass Simon Rodia building the Watts Towers. And I said, what is that funny thing? I'm like, oh, I don't know. It's just some guy doing something. She didn't have any information. But still, it was like a childhood fantasy. What is this magical thing that he's building? And as I became a person who could drive and go places that I wanted, we would go and see the Watts Towers. And I was fascinated because he was recycling. See, and that's what I do. I recycle. You know, and it took me to be an adult to figure out, oh, that's where my influence comes from, you know, of somebody taking something, discards, old dishes and whatever. I think when you look at some of the things that he's done, you see tools impressed in the cement and a corn cob and things like that. Like the cement was right, but he didn't have enough stuff to put in it. And he would put anything, pliers or screwdrivers embedded in it or even made an imprint. So I just like that idea of like taking something other, changing the function of it, and making it into an art object. So that's my strongest connection to Los Angeles.
Now, Simon Rudia was Italian-American, and his watchtowers aren't necessarily political and don't necessarily speak to the African-American experience, whereas your art definitely does and is political. When did you decide that your art had to talk about what was happening in current events?
That was after the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, because I felt such rage. And the whole civil rights movement during that time on television, you could just turn to any station, where people who were marching, the city officials, the police department, the fire department, turned fire hoses on them. They set dogs loose on them. And if you're somebody who grew up in the West and you see that happening, it's really kind of vicious and brutal. So the anger just built and built and built. And then when he was finally assassinated, that, I think it was maybe even the same year that I created The Liberation of Aunt Jemima. I had three kids. I couldn't march. I couldn't go down there, although my neighbors did. I had to stay home with my kids, but I could make art. I could make art to protest. And that's why Aunt Jemima became a warrior.
Describe that piece for us.
It's a plaque that I found at a flea market. It's something that was used in the kitchen. Like, slavery was abolished, but they still made black images in the role of being a servant, like the little guy that held the reins for the horses. Okay, in the kitchen was Aunt Jemima. Her apron was a pad to write your note on, and her hand was a pencil. So you write your shopping list on it. And then there was a whole line developed of Aunt Jemima and Uncle Tom, salt and pepper shakers and sugar holders. You know, they had a function.
I remember Aunt Jemima syrup that you'd put on your pancakes.
Yeah. Yes.
And that was in the 70s.
That was in the 70s. And supposedly, at the beginning, the person who invented the syrup was African-American, but the person who did the publicity for it was a woman in blackface.
It's really interesting how that symbol is viewed so differently now than when it was first in mass circulation, because I think most people saw it as this friendly character, this, you know, friendly, inoffensive character. And the way you saw it was something completely different, as something that is offensive.
Because it was like a derogatory portrayal of black people. And when I started out collecting postcards of derogatory images of black people, and I said, no wonder black people are so undertrodden, because the only image they see of themselves are these derogatory images. So that was why I made her a warrior, not only to fight racism, but to change the image of how she looked.
Well, the gun is such a controversial symbol, obviously, and it's such a figure of violence and, you know, violence in the African-American community. I'm fascinated with your choice of using the guns for these mammy assemblages, yes, replacing the broom with a gun. How do you think of the gun?
For me, it's just a symbol. And the guns that I used are from Barbie's boyfriend, Ken. You know, he's in a uniform or something like that, you know, and that's where I found those little miniature rifles. But it's just a symbol. And I think because I wanted something that was really powerful, like a gun, because I felt so upset about seeing fire hoses turned on people and dogs turned on black people. And I was really angry about that. But then Aunt Jemima came to my rescue. So I gave her a gun. So that's how I got even.
Fantastic. So when we were talking about earlier in the gallery about the clocks and how you feel like things haven't changed or haven't changed enough, yeah, and you look at your body of work and how urgent it has been, and what you were concerned with. What do you think? How do you come away from that thinking about your life and the struggle to for racial equality and for racial justice in your artwork?
Well, art is my vehicle to express the emotions that I feel about racism. And it was very interesting for the opening reception. At least five people came up to me who were from the South, and they were very moved by these pieces. There was one young man, he said, "I'm from really humble beginnings." He's from the Appalachians, and that's pretty humble. Not much money, and he was here in California. He said, I know my grandmother had a washboard. They didn't have washing machine, didn't have like electricity, things like that. So my pieces, and I think this has a lot to do with the scale, is that they're just a little bit larger in their head that would say, when you look across the room, the artist's going to say, come over here and look at me and see what I got to say.
When you look back at your life as an artist, did you envision that you would have taken this path?
No, because I never looked that much into the future about what's going to happen, except that I know that this is my last decade. You know, I can't really envision moving into the hundreds, you know.
Right. Do.
I don't know. I don't particularly want that. Well, you know, because I want to be able-minded. I want to, you know, have a good mind and still make the things and enjoy my family and everything. So I just live for the moment. And I plan next week, but not too much farther.
You still make art.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've just got so much stuff and so many ideas, I don't know how I can get it all done. That's what makes me happy, finding an object and putting it together with two or three other objects. And say, oh, look, this is going to tell a story.
Well, thank you for telling your stories, because I think we are all so much better off for hearing your stories and hearing how, how you have interpreted our history. I started this interview by asking how L.A. influenced you. How do you think you influenced Los Angeles?
I don't know. I taught for a while. I used to be a visiting artist. A lot of people like my art. And I think because there's an element of being human to it, and whether you believe everything I said doesn't matter, but it's like, oh, yeah, this is a part of humanity, and you can like it or you don't like it. But I also know that I have a legacy that two of my daughters are artists, Leslie, who's a painter, and Allison, who's a sculptor. And Allison's two children are artists. So there's something about art that really enriches your life and keeps you going. And I'm proud to have my family be supportive of that.
That's my conversation with Betty Saar from 2017. Her new exhibition, Betty Saar Call and Response, opens this Sunday at LACMA. And don't forget, this week and next, KCRW is taking part in a worldwide collaboration among hundreds of news outlets called Covering Climate Now. As part of that coverage, we'll have an expert answering your questions about climate change early next week. What do you want to know? Ask, and we'll get you the answers. Nothing is off the table. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.